Listeners and Patreon subscribers to the 9-8 podcast, the home of everything progressive and underground right here in Australia. My name is David Ellis, and every week I am joined by the big man himself from the Western Coast, Mr. Alex Odd. Hello, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I am well. I am very, very well. I was actually just saying to Hoggy just before we started that for some reason Hoggy's voice is sounding really weird today. It's like his computer has a little bit of a driver. So I'm going to, you know, just fix that up in post. So if you hear some weird popping and such on his side, that's my fault. You can blame me. But before we jump into today's show, a quick reminder to everyone listening that if you aren't subscribed to the podcast already, please subscribe to the podcast in your podcast player and leave us a review. This greatly helps us to expand the reach of the show and to reach more people, which means, of course, that we can get the word of prog out to more people around the globe. But let's not rant and rave on that for too much. Let's jump into some follow-up. Hoggy, you had a couple of questions for me, I think, from the interview I did with two lads from Bakery Hill.
I did. It's interesting to hear this. You guys sort of briefly touched on it and then kind of scooted past it a bit. The discussion of the intersection between musical theatre and a concept album. Mm-hmm. That, you know, mm-hmm. would be that you could just play the musical as like a 2-hour concept record and, you know, just sort of be sort of seen as a, you know, as a progressive rock concept album, which essentially is kind of what musical theatre is at the end of the day. I mean, that's how it was originally built. You think about, you know, when we go back to sort of the first story-based concept album that I can think of was probably like Tommy by The Who.
Yeah.
And that was often billed as like rock opera. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's just an optics thing now. Maybe we just need to start billing the music as like rock opera instead. Or do you think that's a kind of a dated term? What do you reckon?
Look, maybe. I think what's really interesting and one of the things that was brought up in that interview was that musicals, I think, are starting to come into their own now. You know, we've had a couple of really good ones, particularly in Australia. I mean, around the world, they've kind of always been a thing, particularly in the United States, particularly on Broadway or in the West End in London. But in Australia, they've sort of been, you know, you don't go to see a musical, you go to the theatre or you go to the ballet or what have you. Whereas musicals are sort of like bridging that gap between the people who are the concert goers and the people who love music and all that sort of stuff and the people who like to go and see actors on stage performing something, knowing that there's no, you know, oh shit, I dropped my line, can we just restart that scene again? You know, it's a really, really good art form. The question, I don't think it necessarily needs to be called, you know, rock opera, although I can understand why people would possibly rebrand it that way. But you're right when you talk about, you know, many different albums. I mean, the most recent example I can think of that is the album that had divided the Dream Theater community, The Astonishing. Right. That was one of those albums where I think at the time when it was released, I said, maybe I'm missing something here, but I'm not getting the rest of the story. And everyone who went and saw the live show went, holy shit, this is amazing. But everyone who didn't was sort of like, I'm kind of on the fence about it. So I think it lends a lot more to the actual tale there. And likewise with any musicals that you listen to, you know, Book of Mormon, if you just listen to the album, you kind of don't really get the whole story. You know, I imagine it's the same with Hamilton. I haven't listened to that one yet. You know, Sweeney Todd or, you know,
it's a bit like, and also like Jesus Christ Superstar. There's a certain visual element that you don't get in the stage show. The only other example I can think of off the top of my head is like Shane Warne, the musical, where there's like all sorts of funny stuff going on there, you know, with him on a beanbag texting someone or whatever. But anyway, there's a certain visual element you don't get when you're just listening to the record at home.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there's also the wider story that you don't get. So, yes, the music will kind of tell the story and all that sort of stuff. But if you don't have that, the wider stage play to go off. And this is probably where the difference lies in concept albums and stage plays, in that in stage plays, the music is very much there to support the rest of the story, and it kind of tells a story on its own, but it really is, it's the soundtrack to this particular sound stage play. Whereas concept albums are an all-inclusive big thing, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I did actually find it interesting that we did touch on that as well, and some of the other stuff that we spoke about in that that interview.
The other thing I was going to add to that as well is it's nice to hear Australian voices telling Australian stories, which is something I know you and Tony Burke spoke about at great length when you interviewed him a couple of months ago, right at the very start of all this sort of COVID-19 situation.
Yeah.
We'll get more into some relaying back to what he said later on in the show, because I've got some other points to make about that as well.
So absolutely.
I think that about covers everything for follow-ups. We should just jump into the news. You've got a couple of things here, Dave, about North Lane. Why don't you tell us about that?
Absolutely. North Lane, one of my favorite Australian bands around at the moment. Amazing news if you're a North Lane fan. They've actually released a new single, if you haven't checked it out. If you're a fan, you probably already have. But what you may not know is that the single itself, which is called Clockwork, has actually been selected to be the official theme song for the new Rainbow Six Siege Oceanic Nationals Esports League. For those of you who don't know what that is, Rainbow Six Siege, Tom Clancy's Rainbow Six Siege is its full name, is a video game. It's competitive. It's a really, really fun game. It's basically like a sort of a SWAT game. You play a SWAT team and you kill people, terrorists and all that kind of stuff. Sometimes some people could be the terrorists and the others are the others and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, lots of fun. But it's huge. It's a massive, massive, massive part of the esports community, and these guys have just nailed the theme for it, which is really cool because they're from Australia and I like repping Australian talent, and it's amazing. So it's a huge honor and big congratulations to the guys. If you haven't checked out that new single, check it out. The film clip's actually really cool as well. It looks like it was all kind of done in one take, with, you know, basically like running through a street. It was really, really, really cool. If you haven't checked that out,
we'll put a link. The Weird Al Yankovic film clip for Tacky.
Yeah, in the same...
Except that really was done in one take. I'd be very surprised if this one was.
Yeah, I don't know if this one was or if it wasn't, but it's done really, really, really well. It's really, really cool. Check it out. We'll put a link in the show notes below. And related to that, if you're a bassist and you're listening to this... the band is actually parted ways with their bass player, Brendan Padjicek. So if Brendan's listening to this, all the very best, mate. Touring apparently was not his thing. He wasn't particularly loving that, so he decided to give that away, and I understand that. It can be pretty taxing and tiring when you're doing that a lot. However, if you are a bass player and you are, you know, maybe a big fan of them, hey, drop them a line. You never know. They might need a new bassist coming up soon. Now moving on, new Frost single. Hoggy, tell us about it.
So yeah, the new Frost single is called Terrestrial. It's come off the forthcoming record Day and Age, which is allegedly supposed to be out May the 14th on Inside Out Records. I say allegedly because like record release dates don't seem to mean much at the moment in these COVID-19 times.
No, they don't. Along with the new LTE album, which has been pushed back a month as well.
Yes. Record releases, much like tour announcements, don't seem to mean much, but we'll get to that later. Anyway, what do you think of the new single, Dave?
Oh, very cool. Great song and a really cool video clip. You know I'm all about those video clips. The song is fantastic, and it has sort of a new sort of 80s neo-prog kind of vibe going for it. Like you can kind of almost hear that gated snare. It's really, really awesome. It's a really cool track. And I'll tell you something. If the rest of the upcoming album is going to be like this, I'm going to be all over this album. It's going to be fantastic.
I understand where you're coming from with the 80s neo-prog sounds, but I'm still going to back this one as like the safe one. There's going to be some more out there things on the record. Some of the other stuff on the previous EP was very sort of out there electronically and doing weird shit. Mm-hmm. So I think this is kind of like the safe one. This is kind of like the more straight ahead one, I think, anyway.
Yeah, well, maybe it is. I don't know. I really enjoyed this track. I really, really enjoyed this track. It was a little bit straightforward, but not too straightforward. You know what I mean? Like, it was accessible, but inaccessible at the same time. And you could read into as much of it as you wanted. You could sit back and just enjoy it. Or if you really wanted to like dig deep and dig your teeth in, you could really get some really cool stuff out of it. And I really appreciate that kind of writing because that is hard to pull off.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Very hard indeed. So we mentioned that tour announcements don't seem thing anymore. It's just sort of like tour announcements happen and then things change and things move around.
Which I did want to say, by the way, you called it. Stephen Wilson's cancelled his tour.
Of course he has. It was
called that like three episodes ago. So
yeah,
you know,
he's like, oh, he's announced a tour, and it's like that tour's not happening.
Mm-hmm.
Not at the scale he wanted to anyway, because of the third wave in Europe and all the things that we've spoken about ad nauseum on this show. It's been called off, and you sent me the link to the news. I had many people complaining about it in my news feed, and I'm just like, yeah, well, I kind of knew. Maybe this is like, I don't know. This seemed to affect people in the UK and Europe more than it affected me. Maybe it's just because, you know, we're Australians and we're used to tours getting binned off all the time anyway. So
maybe it is that.
We're kind of inoculated, pun completely intended, to the idea of like tour announcements going away.
Maybe it is that. You know, it could also be simply the fact that, you know, it looked like they were getting on top of it. And I mean, we've been pretty lucky here in Australia with our COVID response and the way that COVID didn't really punch us in the dick like it did kind of the rest of the world.
Well, that's an element of three things. Number one, we're an island. Number two, we're hilariously population sparse. And number three, we locked down pretty quickly and pretty hard. Some people in Victoria may disagree with that sentiment because the lockdown just seemed to last forever over there.
Oh, yeah. But they were in lockdown for, what, like 9 months? It was a long time.
Something like that. And it was sort of like, oh, we're going to release it a little bit. Nope, back in we go. Are we going to release it a bit? Nope, back we go in again, sort of thing. You know, compare and contrast that response to, say, Texas, for example, who just repealed their mask requirements, which is just, anyway, the less said about that, the better, frankly.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But yeah, so interesting. Anyway, I'm sorry, I interrupted you. What were you saying?
Yeah, tour announcements here, there, and everywhere. But we do have a slew of festival announcements that have just been announced in various parts of Australia. Now, Dave, you've been compiling a bit of a list on this, so why don't we run through some of those?
Oh, my God.
Some because I'm given to understand there's quite a few.
Look, there are quite a few. Obviously, Bluesfest is a big one that happens in Byron Bay in New South Wales, which is, for all intents and purposes, Queensland. Splendour in the Grass, which is also happening in Byron this year. I was going to say
Byron Bay, the Bluesfest, for all intents and purposes, which is Queensland, but close enough to the New South Wales border, the people of New South Wales can come up to it, but not subjected to the ridiculous rules that your New South Wales people have to endure.
Exactly. A Splendour, I believe, is coming up as well. Strawberry Fields, which was cancelled last – obviously, most of these are going to be was cancelled last time. Seen and Heard Festival, which is a relatively new one, I believe. And then those are the four basically from this year that are going to be happening in New South Wales. And two of those are basically Queensland. And in Queensland, we've got the Airwaves Festival, Inverted Festival, Big Pineapple Music Festival, CMC Rocks Queensland. And then in Victoria, we've got the Lockhart Music Festival, we've got Zoo Twilights, Beyond the Valley, and a couple of brand new festivals. Well, one old one that they're kind of bringing back and two new festivals as well. So the Inverted Festival, which is it was actually announced sort of tail end of last year, but it's got Skeggs, Spiderbait, The Chats, unfortunately, Trophy Eyes, Wax, Stand Atlantic, and Fangs. Fangs, of course, friends of the show. Hey, guys, thank you for listening. Green Spoon, Regurgitator, and UMI to headline the Spring Loaded Festival, which is it was supposed to be last year and then obviously coming on this year and so on and so forth. And then the Full Tilt Festival, which is a metal festival, which has got North Lane, Hands Like Houses, In Heart's Wake, Thy Art Is Murder, blah, 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 a few others in there as well. Relica, I believe, they're from the Central Coast here in New South Wales. Hi, guys. Congratulations on getting on that bill. So there's quite a few that are happening and quite a few that are actually focusing on, believe it or not, bands, right? So here's my question. There's been a slew of festival announcements. Is this a false dawn or is this a resurgence?
Do you want the horrible negative answer out of me?
I wouldn't expect anything else from you, Hoggy.
I don't think a single one of these festivals is going to happen.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you.
I don't think a single one of these is going to happen. I think there'll be some restrictions placed on size limits, or they won't be allowed to be a dance floor, or they won't be allowed to be moshing, or something like that. And people are just get either the events themselves will become untenable from a practical logistics standpoint, or the people are just going to go, we're not going. A combination of those two factors, I think, will kill all those things off.
Absolutely. I tend to agree with you. I mean, the fact that two of these festivals are not in New South Wales, and the one that is in New South Wales is like a big tour. And it's apparently, according to their site, which, by the way, is on sale tomorrow. The tickets for this are on sale tomorrow as at time of recording.
You're talking about Boys Fest or Splendor?
No, this is Spring Loaded.
Okay.
So Spring Loaded is at the Royal Randwick in Sydney, the lawn at the Royal Randwick. So all outdoors, right? Cairns Showground in Cairns. Then Sandstone Point Hotel in Bribie Island, which is outdoor, I believe. Adelaide Entertainment Centre. I think that might be indoor, that one. Darwin Amphitheatre, that's outdoors. Gosford Entertainment Grounds, that's outdoors. Stewart Park and Wollongong, that's outdoors. And Auditorium in Perth.
The Red Hill Auditorium, that's an outdoor gig as well.
And there's one venue that's TBA in Victoria, right?
Probably trying to find a large field that they can host that one in.
Possibly. But the thing that's really interesting is this is not something that happens over the course of like remember when Big Day Out used to be over the course of like a week?
Speaking of Big Day Out, actually, slight side tangent here. There's actually a Double J podcast about Big Day Out going on that at the moment.
Oh, really?
It's actually not a bad podcast. They spend one episode dunking a little bit too hard on Limp Bizkit because, of course, one of the major markers of the Big Day Out was the tragic death of a fan who got crushed in the pit.
Jessica, who died in 2001.
Exactly. I mean, we don't need to go into the details of it, but if you're at all familiar with the Roskilde Festival disaster that happened in Denmark, Pearl Jam were playing a show, a lot of people got crushed. Broadly, very similar to that.
Yeah, but the barriers collapsed and people were severely hurt.
Yes, people got crushed in the push forward, even though the band were pleading with people to step back.
If you go and look at one of the interviews with Fred Durst, because I believe they had to give evidence at an inquiry.
They did.
And he basically said, no, we told them we didn't want to go on because the barriers were unsafe.
Correct. They didn't have the tea bar. They didn't have any of the things, but festival, it's a whole thing in the podcast. It's very, like, if you want to delve into that situation from 20 years ago, there's a whole podcast series about the Big Day Out and all the problems that are associated with it. It's a very interesting podcasting series.
I'll have to check that one out.
I'll throw a link in the show notes to it if anyone wants to have a listen.
So as I was saying, remember the Big Day Out used to happen like over a week, right? It used to just hit basically every capital city.
Maybe
a fortnight.
I think so. Yeah, it was sort of a five or six day thing. It was probably over a couple of weeks. It would have been a couple of weekends, like a Friday, Saturday, Sunday thing across the country.
No, I'm not sure about whether or not it was a Friday, Saturday, Sunday thing across the country or whether or not they just pounded through the week, because I remember toward the end they were doing it like Monday and Tuesday nights as well.
Do you remember it sort of happening over Australia Day long? If there was an Australia Day long weekend, that's usually when they tried to push together.
Yeah,
you had
a four or five day
window where you could kind of get it done. It was always in the summertime, so it was mostly school holidays for people anyway. So
the
people that wanted to go could go.
Well, the thing that's interesting about the Spring Loaded Festival is that it starts, the first date is the 8th of May and the last date is the 27th of November.
Wait, what?
Uh-huh.
Presumably that's because of the access to the large open-air venues that they're required to use for these sort of things?
I imagine so. But the first date, which is in Sydney, is 8th of May. And then you got 12th of June in Cairns, 19th of June in Bribie Island, 26th of June at the Adelaide Entertainment Centre, 23rd of July in Darwin, 16th of October in Gosford, 23rd of October in Wollongong, 30th of October in Perth, 27th of November in Victoria.
Maybe they had to space that out for like all the quarantining restrictions that are required. If they want to bring in certain headliners for certain shows, they've got to like fly them in and quarantine.
I check correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm fairly certain that all of these are Australian.
All the bands are.
Yeah. So well, Greenspoon, UMI, Regurgitator, Jebediah, Friends of Rom, Magic Dirt, Tumbleweed, Custard, Screamfeeder, The Meanies, The Fobs, and Caligula.
Sounds like an Australian lineup to me.
It sounds like an Aussie lineup to me. There could be a couple in there that maybe aren't, but or maybe Kiwis or something. I'm not sure. But I know at least even the top then, billing the, guys
even,
definitely
even then,
are.
The Kiwis still have to quarantine when they come into Australia anyway. As of this taping, who knows what'll change.
Yeah. But anyway, so the question that I had was, is it a false dawn or is it a resurgence? Because we are starting to see the end almost of the bands. You know what I mean? Like, we've seen this before, to be fair. Towards the end of the 80s, we had, you know, the pop stars and all that sort of stuff starting to take over. And then grunge came through and wiped that out for a bit. And then toward the end of the 90s, we had the same thing. We had, you know, your Backstreet Boys and blah, blah, blah. And they all sort of took off pretty well. And then, of course, this little band called Linkin Park decided to tear the whole new metal thing asunder in 2000. But realistically, in the last 10 years, I can't think of any really big, big, big band that's done that. We've had quite an era of starlets and pop stars and one-man bands. So, I mean, is this kind of like a swan song?
I was
going
to say, the one-man band is definitely something that's come through and become more of a thing.
Definitely.
Tame Impala being the obvious example. That's mostly a one-man project. He has some frequent collaborators, but mostly a one-man project.
Ed Sheeran.
Yeah.
There's a fucking huge example of it.
Yeah.
Kid's insanely talented, and I'm very envious of his talent.
I was
going to
say, your bestest buddy in the world, of course, Taylor Swift.
Yeah, I mean, yes, Taylor doesn't really do everything on her own, though. But yes, like so far as a pop starlet kind of thing is, absolutely.
Yeah. Anyway, False Dawn. This is my answer to this, is a False Dawn. I mean... I think the band as a the band 4-piece, 5-piece guitar, bass, drums, I think that will always exist.
Mm.
Is it always going to be like the dominant means by which people wish to go see live music? I mean, no.
Mm.
I think it's going to be something that will predominantly be catering to an older crowd, of which we are probably the last generation to the back end of.
Well, the thing that's really interesting
kids,
as well
kids
is
below
when
us
you...
now are probably more into different. Like, I don't, like, you know, it's always. I think it's always going to be a part, but I don't think it's going to become the. It's going to be the dominant means.
I think the thing that also is somewhat interesting to me is with the world becoming more and more insular. You know, you've got Europe and the UK having their little feud and all that sort of stuff. The US, which is kind of opening back up again, which is good. But obviously, if another Republican gets in, then they're kind of going to go back the way of Trump, one would think. Australia is notoriously hard to get into. So, I mean, people who are one-man band kinds of things, or it's just them and their guitar, have a financial advantage to touring and things like that straight off the bat. So, you know, from a record label perspective, you'd probably be more likely to take a risk on one person than five people. You know what
and
I mean?
Also, as well, even from like a stage production perspective, you can always hire local crews.
Yes, absolutely.
Unless you're at that sort of U2, Roger Waters, David Gilmour kind of end. But even then, they still have local crews. There's only maybe a baker's dozen or two number of people that tour around with the band.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It is.
But these festival announcements and stuff, I don't actually think any of them are going to go ahead. I think there's going to be a few where they're like, oh, no, you can't have a dance floor, so there's going to be like weird restrictions around where you can and can't be, or how many people are allowed in a certain zone. If you've got multi-stage events, then you can only have so many people in different stages, and it's just going to be I think it may also be a lot of people who are like, you know what, I don't feel necessarily comfortable being around giant crowds again.
Yeah.
There's definitely an element of that in some sectors of the community, probably more on your side of Australia rather than mine.
Yes.
For all intents and purposes, we are effectively back to normal now.
Yeah.
You know, like club gigs have almost restarted again, although it seems mostly cover bands, not originals, which is kind of annoying, but get that. I think the band, I think the venue, that also as well, I think the other problem as well with these festivals and with these other things is I think there's going to be a definite shift more towards established acts and probably even some cover bands as well to generate that revenue that has been lost through this sort of almost 18-month hellscape of like no touring.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we saw that article that came out recently with something like 75-80% of the music industry in Victoria are talking about hanging up their coats.
Yeah,
they just can't keep going.
Exactly. And also, and with capacity restrictions in some venue, in some of the smaller venues and the smaller clubs, it's like they're already sort of operating on the margins when you get 80 to 90% of the capacity of the venue. You put a hard ceiling at 75%, a lot of those gigs now become unprofitable.
That's right.
And then, you know, if the festival decide to book a Perfect Circle, for example, they might go the way of B Prog, my friend.
Hang on, what?
Okay,
I know they played there.
Maybe I need to back up slightly here. There was a conversation on Prog Magazine, right? I know it's kind of a showstopper to drop right in the middle of the thing here, but there was a conversation that happened on Prog Magazine readers about the diversification in the prog scene. We've talked about this on the show before, the rockers and the metalers, right?
Yep,
voiced my opinion that problem, that sort of disconnect between the rockers and the metalers is what killed Big Prog, my friend. Jerry Ewing, editor of Prog Magazine, jumped in and said, no, it was actually the booking of a certain headliner that effectively bankrupted the festival.
Huh.
To which I said, oh, really? Which one was that? It wouldn't happen to be one that turned up with an enormous stage production, a rabid fan base, and a lead singer that appeared in silhouette for the entire show. I'm going to send you a screenshot, Dave, of the conversation that I had with Jerry. Right, it's coming to you on Facebook now.
Righto.
I mean, what do you reckon? You reckon that is about as good as a confirmation to the bit gets?
Look, I'm not going to say definitely yes, but I tell you what, that's close. That's very close to a yes, it was them.
Promoter wouldn't listen. They booked the bands. They asked for some outrageous sum of money, whatever that sum of money was. I don't know what it was. And that sunk the festival.
Wow.
So there you go. Booking huge headliners, not necessarily the ROI. You don't necessarily get the ROI on that one.
No, exactly.
Having said that, though, it was for a festival stage setting thing, it was way over the top. Just like huge lights, massive podiums. Apparently they brought something like 150 crew with them to put that thing together.
What?
Something like that. Well, you're going to need a lot of people. You've only got sort of a half an hour between sets at Big Prog, my friend, anyway. So you're going to need a lot of people to drag everything on stage and set it up.
But still, 150 people is absurd.
Yeah. No wonder they cost so much. You've got to pay all those people.
Wow. Okay.
So, yeah, there you go. As long as that, do I think anyone inside Australia is going to try and charge an astronomical sum of money to headline one of these festivals? I mean, no.
Nah.
Are there bands that are on this festival who probably aren't going to get paid at all and just try and get paid in your favorite term of currency, exposure bucks? I mean, yes.
Yep.
Almost definitely.
Yep.
You know,
I wholeheartedly
we can't afford to pay
that.
You, but we think of the exposure, and it's like, I'll get lost.
Yeah, I know. It's, I mean, in some certain circumstances, I can understand that argument. Genuinely, I can. When you've got if you're a small time band, I mean, everyone's probably got another job. You know, they're probably doing okay, and then they take a Saturday out and they go and they play to 20,000 people at Randwick Racecourse. There's probably going to be a fair amount of exposure on that. You can understand that.
This presupposes the 20,000 people are even going to show up by the time the opening band hits the stage, which we all know doesn't happen.
Oh, absolutely. But, I mean, it's a significant difference between that and playing down at the local pub. You know, where they're like, oh, no, we can't pay you because, you know, blah, but we can give you exposure. It's like, how about you just pay me for my fucking time on a Thursday night playing to three piss heads? Like, that'd be really good.
All the venue turns around and says, bring 75 people with you and we'll book you.
Yeah, exactly. Which is the case of the chicken and the egg.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, I think it's about time for us to jump into our main topic. Despite what you may have thought, that wasn't our main topic. Our main topic this time round is, well, look, last year, as most listeners of the podcast know, I curated a playlist that had every single new prog release that was released that year that was available to me to actually put into this playlist. And I did, and there was a tremendous amount of new music in there, and it was fantastic to listen to it all. And I'm doing the same thing this year. Now, Hoggy actually said to me, hey, is there anything in particular that, you know, you think I should listen to that's really good outside our normal album reviews thing? You know, is there anything that you're champing at the bit to actually get me to listen to? So I sent him an album from a Lebanese prog band called Turbulence. The album is called Frontal. Now, I think you did a bit more of a deep dive on these guys than I did, Hoggy, to be honest with you. So do you want to fill these good people in on what the dealio is with this?
So let's talk about the history of the band for a second. This is their second full album release and apparently got their start in Lebanon as a Dream Theater cover band, which tells you something about the sort of music you're probably going to hear.
Yeah.
They've decided to do a concept album for this release based around the life of Phineas Gage. That name might be familiar to some of you out there. His story is a very interesting one. A railroad worker in America back in the 1800s who got impaled by a steel bar that penetrated his brain. Yes, it's very gross and kind of weird, but he survived. But it was a changed – he was a changed man personally as a personality result. The steel bar went through his frontal temporal lobe, which I'm sure someone far smarter than me could explain to you what that does to your brain and your personality and the rest of it. From my research, though, the extent of his personality changes is debatable, often exaggerated, and even still debated about in psychology circles. So you think, okay, this is a band, it's their second album. They started out as a sort of playing Dream Theater covers. You'd think that maybe this record is just like a pastiche of like riffs and sections they've ripped off from Dream Theater, kind of like what Swappers 11 did to Marillion. But no. This is a mix of influences here. There's bits of Dream Theater, there's bits of Haken. You can definitely hear the Haken. Probably, I think the influence on like a sort of complex story based approach on an album probably comes from Haken because that's kind of something that they do semi regularly. And probably where they got some of the keyboard sounds from, I think. What do you reckon, Dave?
Yeah, absolutely. It is really, really interesting to have a look at these guys musically and go, how have I never heard of you before? Because as you say, they started off as a Dream Theater cover band, and you would expect that given that this is their second album outing, very rarely do you get, and believe me, with the amount of new music I listened to last year and so far this year, very rarely do you get an album that is like the first or second album of a band that has come out and it just knocks it out of the ballpark, right? It's very, very, very rare for that to happen. Usually the influence of that band comes screaming through, right? But it doesn't with these guys. Yes, I can hear particular things, right? So, like I can hear, as you rightly said, you can hear the Dream Theater in there for sure. You can hear the Haken in there for sure. A band that you didn't mention in there, Caligula's Horse. There's a bit of that in there as well. There's a bit of other Aussie prog bands as well in there. It is more crunchy though than Dream Theater, which those of you who are musos will understand what I mean. Dream Theater sort of has this kind of chewiness to it, particularly in the later albums, sort of a bit fatter and a bit wider. Whereas this is a little bit more direct and straight to it in all the tones and everything like that, sort of comes up a little bit more of a package. It's a more metal, modern metal sound, which we don't really get with the DT guys these days, which I know is probably going to cop me some flack, but whatever. It's a bit more aggressive in the guitar tones and things like that as well. The progressions are a bit Dream Theater and a little bit Porcupine Tree as well, in the way that it sort of just pairs back really quickly. You can almost hear that acoustic guitar kind of thing that Stephen Wilson loves to do in the background. they actually remind me a bit of Bad Salad, which was the band that Tiago Campos had a while, or still has, or I don't know.
No, he's still in the band. He's still in the band.
Oh, is he? Okay, yeah. I didn't know if the band still existed even. The last thing I heard from them was a couple of years ago, but...
Yeah, he's still well. I looked it up on their website before we came on air because I saw your notes about Bad Salad, and he's still listed on their website as being in the band, but whether or not the band is still active at the moment, I'm not sure.
But yeah, I mean, it's there were definite moments throughout the album where, like, for example, is it really horrible that I'd like to hear more slide guitar and prog music these days? Like, it's a really underutilized technique. You know?
It does seem to be something that ends up in the keyboard player's department, though, doesn't it?
Yes, you know,
like the guitar is in that sort of context. I imagine the guitar would be used for more the sort of riffage to try and hold down the sort of that solid place that exists, and then the keyboard player does the slidey things over the top with an iPad or a Continuum or a whatever.
Yeah, some or other insert some kind of Rudess invention.
Exactly. Exactly.
Or utilization.
Exactly. One of those things that, you know, and then you can hold that place down while the other things go on top.
Absolutely. But I don't know, just the use of the slide guitar really brought a smile to my face as I'm listening through. I'm like, that's cool. I don't hear enough of that, you know? And
here's the question,
the guitar,
though. Are you sure it's a slide guitar? Are you sure it isn't actually the keyboards?
No, it's definitely a guitar. You can hear it. You can hear in just the articulation on it and so on and so forth. I mean, I might be wrong. I might be wrong, but I'm fairly certain that it's a...
Well, we are frequently wrong about many things on the show. We thought on the thematic Skyrunner album it was a trumpet, and it wasn't.
Yes, that's true. That's true. I mean, if we're... By all means, get in touch with us and tell us we're wrong. We're more than happy to wear egg on our face. But on the guitarist as well, the guitarist himself, which is Alain, I think. I don't know if that's how you... I don't know if you just say your name Alan or if it's Alain. I'm sorry if I'm butchering
it. Or Alan
or whatever. This guy's a fucking monster. Like, holy shit. Yeah, there's a bit of Petrucci in there, and I'm pretty sure he plays a Petrucci signature, and I'm pretty sure he's nailing his tones from Petrucci, but that's okay. Everyone goes through wanting to copy Petrucci because...
I was going to say... Who isn't in the prog space? Who doesn't draw influence from John Petrucci? Yes, okay, you mix in other things, but like, there's always some base of John in there somewhere.
Absolutely. There's definitely that here, but there's also a lot of other stuff in here. Like, there's chromatic runs as well, which I presume are from the likes of Vai. Okay, that one's pretty normal. Steve Vai tends to show up in many prog things. And I heard a bit of Stefan Schackinger in there as well, which is a really weird thing.
I was going to say, that name doesn't ring a bell. Fill me in here.
He's a progressive swamp guy who was on Candy Rat Records many years ago. I don't even know what he's doing now. But he is also a monster of a guitarist and real kind of bluesy prog with like chromatic runs and crazy stuff in there as well. Again, nutter of a player, but I just got that vibe of Schackinger. Again, could be completely wrong. But yeah, I don't know. What other elements stood out to you, Hoggy, on this album?
Every now and then I hear a little bit of and this may be just because of like the pre-reading of learning that they were a Lebanese band. I thought I heard some like an Eastern influence, like in the background, there'd just be these sort of little moments. Mm-hmm. Of like an Eastern sort of Arabic. I know that's a kind of a dirty word to say with Lebanese people. I'm sorry, but there's that sort of feel to some of the backing parts to the songs.
Yep.
Particularly in Dreamless, I think there's a bit of that going on.
Oh, God, that's a good song. A good song.
Very nice change with like all the big power stuff and then just sort of this shift. It's really nice to hear.
Absolutely. One of the things I think this album does extremely well, and these guys obviously as musos do extremely well, is that thing that I alluded to it before that Porcupine Tree does extremely well, where you've got this just absolute tearing, you know, punchy, huge, metally kind of thing, and then it just pairs back to this, you know, acoustic guitar or piano or something with this really gorgeous voice over the top, and you go, okay, that's really cool. You know, they do that really, really well. And I've seen it crop up in a couple of things recently, but I haven't seen it done as well as this. You know, it's amazing. As you mentioned, Dreamless is an amazing breather because you've spent the first two tracks basically hanging on for dear life, and then it just drops into this gorgeous, ethereal, reverb-filled, juicy thing. Yeah, it's amazing. Did you hear any Chaos Divine in the vocals?
There's a bit of that in there. There's a bit of that there. I wonder if there's not. Maybe it's just because we're so exposed to it here in Australia, having listened to all of the Australian great prog metal that's coming out at the moment. Hmm. There is definitely an element of, you know, somewhere between David and Jim Gray with the vocals going on there.
Hmm.
I'm not sure who the influences are, or whether it's directly that, or whether it, you know, it's just a combination of a whole bunch of things. There's definitely an element of that in the vocals, I think. And even some of the choices of melody as well, I think.
Mm, I agree. I agree with you. And even the overall tones are, dare I say it, it's good. This album definitely has that kind of Australian tonal quality to it. So I was expecting, given that I was hearing a lot of Australian vibes and so on and so forth, I was expecting that this was going to be mixed by our boy Forrester Saville. But I thought it seemed a little bit heavy for him because Forrester generally backs back on the gain and all that kind of stuff. And it's not. It's mixed by Lucas De La Rosa. Now, Lucas De La Rosa is a bullshit crazy guitarist from Spain, I think, over there somewhere. He's European anyway. This is a guy who does videos of, like, you know, the Rachmaninoff on the guitar, and he just bullshit crazy. Really, really cool album. He had an EP that came out last year. It was really, really awesome. I didn't realize that he was a mixer and master. But it was produced by Elaine from the band. So,
okay. Yeah, self-produced, and then they get someone in to mix and master. Okay.
Yeah. Which is a really good way to go about it when you think about it.
I think so. Unless you're like Devin Townsend, who's like really, really good at that sort of stuff himself, and even then he sometimes gets people to do it, other people to do it for him.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, I mean, what about standout tracks for you? I already mentioned Dreamless, but what about some of the other standout tracks on this album for you?
A Place I Go to Hide is an excellent track. I thought that it was very, very well done. Mm-hmm. But also as well, like, even not even necessarily whole songs, there's some like great middle sections to songs that show off their instrumental prowess without being ridiculously bloated, like that record that you gave to me last week, whose name escapes me for good reason. There's no blo- – I mean, the song I was going to call out for that was Crowbar Case. Very nice middle section there. Dual leads and instrumentation and tricky sort of stuff, and then comes back to the song again. And it was really, really good, and it didn't feel unnecessarily long-winded. As other bands have, Dream Theater being the obvious one, of course, is like they do that and then they just sort of go on and on and on and on and on. And I think even they've realized themselves and say, we don't really need to do that. It's not really, we've kind of done that. We don't need to do any, do heaps of long stuff.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. A Place I Go to Hide, that whole middle section where there's that build up and everything that's going in there, fucking hell, that is good. Like, just listening to it and going, there's something really pleasing about a really well-done build-up. I know that sounds basic as shit, but there is something really pleasing about it. And there's something really pleasing about it being done in the middle of a song. Like, recorded version, not just like a live version or anything, you know. It's just absolutely sensational. Really, really, really well done. I don't know. I don't know what else to say. I mean, it's good from start to finish, and it's gonna be in my top 10. That's for sure. Like, it will be. It'll be up there. I was listening to it the other day at work, and I just the guy sitting, poor bastard, sitting next to me, George, and he just goes. He's sitting there listening to me, muttering to myself, going, "Fuck, that's awesome. Oh, fuck, this is sick." You know, he's like, "You all right?" And I'm like, "Yeah. I'm just listening to this song, this album." And he's like, "Oh, is it good?" I'm like, "It's fucking ball terror." He's like, "Would I like it?" And I'm like, "No, you listen to hip hop. Fuck off."
That right there, I think, is the sort of quintessential like fracturing of the music in today's society. You got a guy who listens to hip hop and a guy who listens to prog metal.
Absolutely.
I don't think there's a combination that we've actually heard. combination of rap and progressive metal. We're sure rap and metal have been done plenty of times. Look at rap and progressive metal.
Yeah, I don't know. I know there's a band out recently, I think called Devastator, who were doing like newer metal with rap over the top. And it was actually pretty good. It's kind of like what Linkin Park could have been if they hadn't gone.
If they hadn't immediately pivoted, if they hadn't immediately pivoted away from new metal towards more of a sort of hard rock kind of direction,
which arguably was the reason they got as big as they did. So, you know,
Enough. There was, and also as well. There's only so much of you can do as you keep getting older as well. You kind of got to move. Yeah, I don't think I've actually heard anyone do rap and progressive metal yet. That's probably the one thing that hasn't been done.
I wonder if there's a reason for that.
Probably because it'd be. I imagine, although I have heard other artists say differently. I think it was Chris Cornell who said this. He said he found it much easier to write melodies and lyrics to something that was in an odd time because there's only one spot for it to go. Whereas in 4/4, you can kind of do whatever, wherever.
Yeah, that's right.
Whereas
if you're
writing something in 7 or in 9 or whatever, it's the melody only sort of goes in one spot. You're gonna go. So maybe there's the problem with rap. If you're trying to do something in a complex time signature, the words and the rap and the thing is harder to kind of flow together. Maybe also it's just a stylistic thing. I'm like, yes, there are many rap songs that are very political. Arguably, it started in a political direction, then subsequently got co-opted into a more of a popular direction, singing less about politics and more about partying.
Maybe
that's the – yeah. I don't know. It'd be interesting to hear.
Yeah, I don't know.
And anyway, I was going to say, the only thing I was going to add to that, if anybody out there knows of a band that has done rap and progressive metal together, please, by all means, send me a link, because I'd love to hear some.
Yeah, me too,
someone
actually.
Someone must have done it. It must have been done at some point.
It seems that everything's been done, and if not, then The Simpsons did at some point. So, this is an absolutely sensational album. You all need to go out and listen to it, and we're working on actually getting the guys to come on the show. But you know, time zone differences, so we're just trying to work a couple of things out. So I reckon, given that we've just done a big album review, we should jump into our album reviews, because I heard that you like album reviews, so I'm going to have an album review with your album review. What do you reckon?
Album reviews after the album reviews. That sounds like a brilliant idea. Let's do that. Right, so the album that I gave you was a collaboration between Antoine Fafard and Gavin Harrison called Chemical Reactions. What did you think of this?
This was a really, really cool album. Look, I'm not the biggest fan of the harder kind of jazz stuff and tech jazz and all that kind of stuff. Not really my cup of tea.
Yeah, I was going to say. Fusion is definitely not the thing that you're interested in. There is a monstrous amount of jazz fusion going on at the moment, and I know basically none of it is sort of up your street, really.
But I can certainly see why people love it, and I can certainly see the complexity and the talent that is required, which is obviously why they got Gavin Harrison to drum on it, and the drumming is fucking insane. I mean, the composition of the entire album, the actual put together and the way that the album works and all the music on it is just amazing. Like, it's really good. If you're a jazz head, if you love anything to do with even remotely stuff like jazz and fusion and all that sort of stuff, listen to this. It's amazing. Not exactly my cup of tea, but I can certainly appreciate the shit out of it.
It's interesting, actually, because I think there's a very, very large crossover between jazz fusion and progressive metal.
Given absolutely.
Lots of the progressive metal guys were very heavily influenced by jazz fusion, by Chick Corea, by the Mahavishnu Orchestra, by Alan Holdsworth, by Aldo Meola, even, who did a little bit of jazz fusion stuff before it morphed, moved into a Latin direction. But, you know, there's a very, very large crossover between prog metal and jazz. Even like the Dixie Dregs, for example, ostensibly not necessarily a jazz fusion band, but they definitely had jazz fusion elements.
Yes.
So there's definitely a large crossover between those two worlds. And jazz fusion, and jazz fusion is all about just ridiculous technicality, sort of eight bar, sixteen bar phrases where they just go nuts and push the boat out technically with lots of very complicated technical, like very complicated musical passages.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It is extremely good. And if it's, it is really, I know they say that Dream Theater is musicians' music, but honestly, this is like the next step.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. This is way further out there than that. And like, I've just listed a whole bunch of bands there. If like, if you want to dig into the jazz fusion thing, there is a whole, there was a whole world of jazz fusion that went on, mostly around the '70s. Actually, to be honest,
it was a little bit of
crossover. I mean, like everybody holds up Relayer as like the beginnings of progressive metal, which is complete bollocks. But there is a bit of that jazz fusion element in Relayer. So there's this crossover there, like through the '70s, it was huge. And then it kind of died a death at the hands of punk and disco, like everything else did.
Yeah. And I mean, if you want to start somewhere that's maybe not as brain meltingly, intrusive, start with Steely Dan. They were probably the biggest jazz fusion band that's ever been.
Really? You know, Steely Dan?
Absolutely.
Interesting.
Absolutely. They had number ones. I don't know of another jazz fusion band that had number one hits. And this is back in the day when a number one hit actually meant something. It wasn't just
exactly. As opposed to now where you can almost get a top 20 hit with a couple of hundred purchases and a few streams.
That's right. Yeah. No, this is back when it actually meant something and they had airtime and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I can tell you, having seen them, they were absolutely sensational. One of them, unfortunately, has passed away. But to one of the two guys, absolutely amazing. And they're a lot more accessible, particularly if you're into like rock and things like that, it will be a great doorway for you to get into, progressive, jazz and jazz and fusion and things like that. Cause they do things really, really, really well. Now, moving on to the one that I gave you, Hoggy, Downs Braid Association's Halcyon Hymns. What do you think?
This was very, I mean, in the way that I gave you a record that wasn't necessarily up your street, you very much gave me one that was in very much in my street. This is very much the sort of British Euro prog kind of sound, but not in the way, I mean, yes, this is an album cover by Roger Dean. Yes, Jeff Downes is on the record. So you're thinking of Yes, you're thinking of Asia, you're thinking of the Buggles and that sort of thing. But this wasn't just a straight up pastiche of just, you know, stuff that could have appeared on a Yes or Asia record. There's some very nice melodies here. However, the spoken word sections that were through some of the record, in addition to like sung lyrics, it's very odd, and I'm not sure really added anything. It's just very, very strange sort of spoken word passages, sort of like a narrator, but not necessarily narrating anything to do with the story, as far as I can work out. So it was kind of strange. But the question I had for you is on the last episode, you said to me that you thought this was probably going to be your album of the year. Why? What's here that puts this as your album of the year? Because this, while being a very good album, wasn't necessarily some earth-shatteringly great record for me. So I'm going to throw this one back to you. What was there?
Sure. It goes back to a comment I made earlier in the show, and that is, it's one thing to write good music, right? It's another thing to write good pop music. It's another thing entirely to be able to do both of those very well at the same time. You know, you think about, and I'm not necessarily people who are about to start writing angry emails, just stop for a second, okay? Not necessarily putting these guys in the same league, right? But you think about bands like the Beatles. Think about bands like ABBA. Think about bands like, I'm just trying to think of something. Yeah, Michael Jackson. Dare I say Metallica? I mean, although it's not really pop music, but, you think about the songs that those particular people have written and how not only are they indicative of very much an era and a genre and it's absolutely unbelievable music that they were writing, particularly for the time, but they're great pop songs. They're just good to listen to, right? I don't have to sit down and go, oh, what are they doing there? That's really cool. And, you know, if I miss a bit, I have sort of have to go back and, I can do that, and I can sink my teeth in as deep as I want to go in this and listen to all the lyrics and listen to all the instruments going on in the background, the harmonies and the everything that's going on that's just absolutely fantastic. But then if I want to just put it on in the car while I'm driving and have people talk to me in the car, I can also do that. And that's a really hard thing to do. It's a really rare, really, 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 really rare thing to do. For me, this album, particularly there are a couple of songs that really stood out to me. Love Among the Ruins, the opening track. She'll Be Riding Horses is absolutely fantastic. And as is Holding the Heavens. They're just great songs. And it's one, as I said, it's one thing to write a great prog song. It's another thing to write a great pop song. It's another thing entirely to be able to mix those two together. And I think they've done it extremely well.
Okay, that's a very interesting way of looking at it, actually. I hadn't thought of that. Fair enough. I understand where you're coming from. There's sort of like those, the prog and the pop elements. Something that I think Asia probably did the best out of all of them.
And you know what I mean? It's another thing as well to blend those two things and be able to get people from both sides of the spectrum. So, you know, someone who's a big pop head who listens to Top 40 and that's it, they would like this album. Someone who's a massive prog head who loves Genesis, yes, Rush, you know, the Buggles, you know, all that Euro prog stuff would love this album. It's very rare that you get those two people in the same room going, yeah, this is good, you know.
That's so true. That's very true.
It's I think it's very good. But then again, that's just me and I'm happy to be wrong. But the question is, Hoggy, what have you got for me for next week?
Okay, I have an album that's put out last month by a local Perth band called Mount Mountain. The album is called Centre. I want you to have a listen to it and tell me what you think.
Beautiful, beautiful. I will.
What have you
check
got for me?
I have an album, and I want to get your opinion on this one because I think it's going to be really, really interesting. It's an album by a band called The Elephant in the Room. And the album is called The Elephant in the Room. I'll get you to have a listen to that and tell me what you think.
Alrighty. So I'll listen to that and report back to you in a few weeks' time. I think that about wraps it up for this episode of the 9-8 Podcast. If you would like to find the show notes for this episode, you can find them at 98podcast.fireside.fm/70. You can find us on Twitter at 98fm or one word. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/98fm. In addition to that, if you would like to and you are able to, please consider supporting us on Patreon. Right after we're finished with this, we're going to record an after show where we're going to talk about some other stuff that doesn't really fit the show, but I still want to have a chat with Dave about those topics.
Beautiful.
So you can find that at patreon.com/98podcast, and you can find the link for that in the show notes for this episode.
Awesome. Once again, thank you very much for joining us on the 9-8 Podcast. It's an honor to be blessing your ear holes once every fortnight or 3 weeks or whatever it is at the moment. Our schedules are playing hectic, but don't worry, we'll be back to regular programming as soon as we can. So thank you very much for joining us this week. My name is Dave Ellis.
My name is Alex Holland. Thank you very much. We'll see you all next time.